Sir. The sun rises in the evening. Talk and then. Discourse number 4. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
The first question. What if there are only mirror and mirror and mirror reflecting each other? Prabuddha, it is so. Precisely, that's how it is. Because all is consciousness. Consciousness is a mirror. Mirror reflecting mirror. When your consciousness is clean, clear, unobsessed by anything, unoccupied, this is how one realizes reality. All is one. The same consciousness. And this is the beatitude, the benediction, the splendor. Once it happened, Ramakrishna was drinking tea. Few disciples were sitting there. Vivekananda was also there. And Ramakrishna started saying that this cup of tea is God Himself. Now this was too much for Vivekananda. He was a well-educated man, logical, rational. This looked absolute nonsense. A cup of tea and a God? Ramakrishna must be mad. Now this is going too far. What? To reject the whole idea, he went out. Just as a protest. He didn't say anything to Ramakrishna. But the protest was there, he simply went out. Another friend of him followed him. And the both started smoking outside the temple. And they were laughing and joking about Ramakrishna. And the absurd thing sometimes he says, now look, a cup of tea and God. This is utter nonsense. When they were talking, suddenly Ramakrishna came out. They were a little embarrassed because they were smoking. And Ramakrishna touched Vivekananda. And suddenly everything changed with that touch. And he could see even the cigarette and the smoke as God. And for 3 days, that consciousness persisted. After 3 days, he fell in Ramakrishna's feet and said, I'm sorry. Everything is God. Now I know. But give me back that experience. Now I don't want to come back. Ramakrishna said, giving, it can't be eternal. You will have to come back unless you rise to it. It was a gift. It was as if somebody is asleep and dreaming and you shake him up and he opens his eyes and looks at you. But his inner sleep is not complete. For a moment he wakes up and then he falls into sleep again. Ramakrishna said that it was just like that. I simply shook you up because I could see the protest. I could see that you think this is absurd. And it looks absurd. because we don't know what reality is. I am reflecting you, you are reflecting me, and so on and so forth. The trees are reflecting you, and you are reflecting trees, and so on and so forth. All mirrors, in all shapes and sizes. This is a mirror valley. Consists only of mirrors, because consists only of consciousness. The only discovery of all the Buddhas is that only consciousness is real. Only consciousness is. You can call it God. You can call it enlightenment. You can call it nirvana. Or whatsoever you choose to call it, you can call it. But those are only names, differences in names. The message is simple and clear and loud, that we all consist of pure consciousness. Just for a moment even, if you can stop the constant flow of thought, you will be able to see it. The second question, when the internal talking is stopped, is this enlightenment? Paribesh, when the internal talking is stopped, who cares? Who is there to care? Who is there to raise the question, is this enlightenment? If you can still ask the question, then it is internal talking continuing. If you can still see that this is enlightenment, then nothing has happened. Then the mind is back from the back door. It has jumped upon your enlightenment too, and it has destroyed it. Enlightenment is not an experience. That's why nothing can be said about it. Enlightenment is not one of the series of the experiences that you have lived through. Enlightenment is not something that happens to you like a content in the mind. When the mind is not there, you don't say this is enlightenment. You don't feel it as an experience. Rather, on the contrary, you see it as your nature. It has always been so. Just because of that internal talk, you were too much occupied and you could not see it. It is not a realization. It is only a recognition, a remembrance. It has been always so from the very beginning. Just you had got lost into thoughts, fantasies. Now the fantasy is no more there, you are back home. It is your home. Enlightenment is not an experience, it is your interiority. It is you. One does not become enlightened. One comes to know that one is enlightenment. One is light. One is consciousness. But Paribesh, your question is philosophical. When the internal talking is stopped, you ask, is this enlightenment? Don't be philosophical about these things. These are not philosophical things. You cannot think about them. You can only be and know. be Istin and no. If I say yes, this is enlightenment, I will be only giving you an idea that will burden your mind more, that will become part of your internal talk. Then you will not talk much about money and women, and you may start talking about enlightenment, God, Buddhahood. But it is the same. The object of thinking does not matter much. You can give any object, and the thinking can weave and spin around it. The question is that the thinking disappears, evaporates. So don't make enlightenment in any way a goal. Enlightenment is the very source, the very ground of your being. You consist of enlightenment. You are made of this stuff called enlightenment. So naturally, when you are silent and there is no distraction, thought means distraction. Thought means going away from yourself. Thought means something has come between you and yourself. Thought means you have moved into the future or into the past. Thought means you are not here, you are not now. All this is implied in thought. When there is no distraction, you relax into your soul. Slowly, slowly, you rest into your being. Martin Heidegger has called this resting into yourself the releasement. He has also called it the enchanted reasoning. There is a reason inside you, the enchanted reason, a space where you are still God, where you have not fallen at all, where you cannot fall in the very nature of things, where you still live in the Garden of Eden, where the fall has not happened, cannot happen. One cannot fall from God and God's paradise. One can only fall asleep. This is my interpretation of the biblical story. Adam has not been driven out of the Garden of Eden. He has fallen asleep. By eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge, he has fallen in dreams. He has started thinking. That is the meaning of the whole parable. That is the meaning of the symbol, the tree of knowledge. He has started thinking. Thinking, he has gone away. In thinking only. Otherwise, he lives in the same place. But he is no more available to God. He has moved into fiction, imagination. Wake up. And you have always been enlightened. Just wake up. Open your eyes. Don't let enlightenment become an idea in you. Otherwise you will think about it and that will be a distraction. The third question, where is the love in Buddha's teachings? I can't feel it. It is like going to a chemist's shop and telling him, I can see all kinds of medicines and drugs here, but I don't see any kind of health. Medicines bring health. They have to be absorbed. Then they change your chemistry. Health arises, is discovered. Buddha does not talk about love. He is simply giving you the key to inner change. If you use the key, Love will arise. Love will flow. Love will be a consequence. What is the point of talking about health? A person goes on talking about health, you are ill, and he goes on talking about health and never gives any medicine to you. How long you are going to listen to this man? Sooner or later you will be fed up and you will say, I'm fed up. Give me some medicine. I have come here not to listen about health. I have come here to be healthy and whole. Talking won't help. So Buddha does not talk about love, but he prepares the ground where love blooms. You will not find in Buddha's teachings any talk about love. He has not even used the word love. But he is a scientist of the soul. He simply gives you medicines. Health is going to happen within you. There is no need to talk about love. There is no need to talk about God. There is no need to talk about the ultimate result. All that is needed is to persuade you, to seduce you into taking the medicine. You are like a small children who will not take the medicine. And medicines are bitter. And they will run and escape from the mother. And they will hide and they will say, we are not going to take this medicine, this is too bitter. Their whole concern is that the medicine should be a sweet thing. They are not concerned about the outcome. They are concerned only with the momentary taste. And there are many in the world who become attached to teachings which look sweet. Buddha may not look very sweet. He is not. He is bitter. He himself has called that he is a physician. That his approach is not that of a preacher, but that of a physician. He treats ill people. And this whole world is a hospital. Everybody is ill. What do you want? You want Buddha to talk about love? How that is going to help you? And how you are going to understand it? He will talk about love, his love, and you will understand about love, your love. And they are poles apart, diametrically opposite. His love is a state. It is not a relationship. His love does not depend on anybody else. His love is simply his overpouring. He is so full that he has to go on overflowing. He has to go on sharing. He is super saturated, super abundant. There is no way he can avoid loving. He is love. When you are in love, you are not love, you are only in love. When you are in love, it is a kind of relationship, a need. You are a beggar. When you are in love, you are asking for love. Give me love. That's what you call love. Even if you have to give a little bit, you give it only in the bargain. But you want to snatch more than you have given. That's the conflict between all the lovers. Husbands and wives. Continuously fighting and quarreling. What is the base of it? Each is thinking, I am giving more and receiving less. The other is cheating. Both want to cheat each other. And I can understand what is the problem. When you are asking for love, One thing is certain, you don't have any love in your being. Otherwise, why you should ask? If you have, you need not ask. You will be fulfilled by it. It will be welling up in you. It will be flowing. In fact, you will ask people to receive, to open their hearts. And you will feel grateful to people who receive your love. You will not be a beggar. You will be an emperor. Buddha is an emperor. He gives. And he is thankful to all those who receive. When you go in love, you are just a beggar. Two beggars begging each other. The outcome is misery. The outcome is ugly. The outcome is hell. Buddha's love is not a relationship. It is relating. He simply relates. But there is no bondage in it. There is no obsession with any person in particular. Buddha, talking about love, will be saying something else. You will understand something else. That's what happened with Jesus. He is talking about love, but he has been not understood at all. A church has arisen around him, which is unloving, absolutely unloving. Otherwise, how can you explain all the wars that have happened between Christianity and other religions, all the crusades, all the murder, killing, and all the bloodshed? Jesus may have talked about love, which is the love of a Buddha, but the followers, they will understand in their own way. And when your understanding is not clear, great things can become great dangers. Buddha has not talked about love. And Buddhism is the least ugly religion in the world. And he has not talked about love your neighbor as yourself. And he has not given you any message to serve people. But he has given medicine. His meditations are his medicines. If you go into meditation, love will arise. It is a consequence. You ask to feel. Where is the love in Buddha's teachings? There is no love in the teachings. Teachings are medicinal. You go into those teachings. Let those teachings become your heart. Let understanding arise, and you will find love following that understanding, coming as is said. It need not be talked about. Love will come. You forget all about love. It comes on its own accord, becomes silent. That's why I can understand your question. It is relevant. Many have asked it before. One expects a Buddha to talk about love. But your expectations are your expectations. No Buddha is obliged to fulfill them. He has to work from his vision. His vision is that you need an alchemical change in your consciousness. Then love will come. It will be a flowering. Look at a gardener. When he is cleaning the ground to plant rose bushes, are there any flowers? And if you see the gardener cleaning the ground and removing the stones and rocks and replacing earth, he will be puzzled, where are the rose flowers? And then he brings the rose bushes, and you will be puzzled, where are the rose flowers? And then he plants the rose bushes and waters morning, evening, and takes all kinds of care, and you go on wondering, where are the roses? But one day, suddenly, you wake up in the morning and the fragrance is there. The bush is aflame with flowers. Just like that it happens. Love will come on its own. You cannot bring it. And the love that you practice will be false, artificial, an artifact. Love has to descend. It has to come from above. Then it is divine. And then it has a totally different sound to it, a different dance to it. Then it doesn't bring misery. Then it creates celebration in existence. The fourth question. Do you know anything about the Radha Swami religion and its master Saint Charan Singh Ji? I have recently read 3 books from the Radha Swami and would like you to comment on their beliefs. First, that there has always been at least one living master since before Buddha's time, and Charan Singh is the current one. Second, that their audible sound currents and 5 sacred mantras are the only valid meditation. Third, that only Charan Singh can connect one to the sound currents. Fourth, if you become his disciple, you may have to go through other incarnations, but never lower than you are now. Fifth, that there are at least 7 heavens, each higher than the other, and only Charan Singh can take you up. Other saints can only take you up to the 2nd heaven, where Jesus and Buddha live. I am not a disciple of Charan Singh, and have no desire to become one, but the Radha Swami books did leave me very puzzled. It is all bullshit. First, that there has always been at least one living master since before Buddha's time, and Charan Singh is the current one. If all is divine, this is nonsense. These are old ego games. The whole existence is full of God. And it is not that somebody is more of a God and somebody else is less of a God. God is not a quantity. It can't be more and less. The idea that only one or two or three or four or 5 masters are there. Makes it appear as if God has also limitations. There are no limitations. The master is hiding in everybody. The real master is never outside. The real master is inside. The outside master is just to provoke the real master within you, that's all. Somebody has awakened and you are fast asleep. But you have as much capacity to be awake as the one who has become awakened. The capacity is there, intrinsic in you. And the outer masters, the person who is awakened, cannot give you awareness. He can only say, awareness will well up within you. He is not going to give it to you. Nobody can give anything to you. You need not have anything from anybody. God has given you all that you need, all that you will ever need. When you shake up somebody, when you call him and he opens his eyes and becomes awake, have you given him anything? You have not given him anything. You simply created an occasion in which his capacity to be aware is started functioning. A master is just a device. There are thousands of masters around the world. And the people who claim that I am the only one, be certain, at least they are not. Because the person who has arrived, how he can claim that I am the only one? He will know, at least this much he will know, that there are. The earth is big. And life does not exist only on the earth. It exists at least on 50,000 more planets. Just one master sharing, it will be too much for him to manage. Think of poor sharing too. It will be too much. The world is vast. There are thousands of masters. And not only on the earth, but on other planets too. Wherever there are people, at least few people are always awake. And remember, the person who is awake cannot claim anything about his awareness, about his awakened state. Because he knows that he is awake only because he is capable of falling asleep. And those who are still asleep are capable of becoming awake. You can fall asleep only because you can have awareness. Otherwise, how can you fall asleep? Awareness is a must. Sleep and awareness both are manifestations of awareness. In sleep, the awareness becomes a seed form. It closes itself. Just you close your windows and doors in the night and go to sleep. In the morning you wake up, you open the windows and doors again and you allow the light to enter in. And even people who are asleep sometimes become awake, even sometimes without a master. Because life itself sometimes can provoke you into awareness. The master is not a must. There are people who have become awakened without any master. Just by going deep into the misery of sleep, into the nightmares of sleep, they have become awakened. The very again has disturbed their sleep. Master is only one of the situations, and nobody who has arrived can claim that I am the only one. If the claim is there, then it shows only one thing, that this man is fast asleep and dreaming. Second, that their audible sound current and five sacred mantras are the only valid meditation. There are millions of meditations in the world, invented, discovered down the centuries. And any meditation is valid if it reaches you. Validity has nothing to do with meditation. You will be surprised to know that the English poet Tennyson used to use his own name as a mantra. Tennyson, Tennyson, Tennyson. He will repeat it a few times, and that will give him such peace and silence. Now your own name can do it. It is not a question of any special sound, that when you repeat Rama, Rama, or Om, Om, or Allah, Allah, then you will wake up. It is, again, somebody is asleep. Create any noise around him. Rama, Rama, or Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola, or Live a Little Heart, Sippa Gold Spark, anything. Just go on repeating it. And the man is bound to open his eyes and he will say, what are you doing? Why are you disturbing my sleep? Have you gone mad? Any sound will work because all sound are divine. All names are his. Yes, Coca-Cola too. Remember again Ramakrishna, if a cup of tea is God, why not Coca-Cola? In fact, Coca-Cola is the only international thing in the world. The only, even in Soviet Russia, Coca-Cola. They may not love American way of life, but they love Coca-Cola. That should be the universal symbol of brotherhood and love. You may not believe in somebody else, God, in his church, in his temple, in his scripture, but as far as Coca-Cola is concerned, nobody is a Mohammedan, nobody is a Hindu, nobody is a Christian. Coca-Cola is a Christ symbol. Any sound will do. All that is needed is a constant repetition and with awareness. When you are repeating any sound, just remain watchful. If you are not watchful, then no sound will do. Then you can have the best mantra in the world, given by the most enlightened person. It won't work. It works only if you are in a witnessing state. You repeat the word and you remain a witness to it. You repeat Rama, 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 and deep inside you are watching. Watching that you are repeating it. Watching the sound arise, watching the sound taking form, moving, slowly disappearing, watching the gaps between two Rama. And it slowly, slowly make the sound more and more subtle. So there are four stages of mantra. First, repeat it loudly so others can hear it. Because you are not alert enough. If you repeat it only inside without your lips moving, you may not be able to be aware. It has to be shouted. It has to be loud. As if somebody else is repeating it, Rama, Rama, Rama. You have to be alert. You cannot fall asleep. When you have learned that, then repeat it with closed mouth, your lips not moving at all. Just repeat it inside. It will be in your throat. it has become a little more subtle than the grass loud repetition. Then go a little further deeper. Then don't repeat it. At the third stage, don't repeat it. Let it happen. If you have worked on the sound for long, then it repeats itself. It becomes autonomous. And you know, sometimes you know, a line of a song becomes autonomous and it goes on repeating itself. You don't want to repeat it. You are doing something and it comes suddenly and it starts repeating. It drives you crazy too. The same happens if a person has been working years on a sound. There is no need to repeat. He simply sits soundly, silently and the sound comes up. It starts repeating. You are just a listener, a watcher. This is the third stage. And the fourth stage is the sound disappears completely. There is no repetition. Only the watcher is left. These four stages of sound repetition or mantra or chanting are just to learn how to be aware. You can use any sound. That's why I say this is all nonsense, that their audible sound currents and five sacred mantras are the only valid meditation. You can create your own meditation. And my feeling is that will be far more valid, because whatsoever you like and love is going to be have a deeper impact in your being than anything else. Third, only Charan Singh can connect one to the sound current. You are connected with it. You are not disconnected with it. Nobody is needed to connect you with it. These are the people who exploit you. If you are not connected with that current of life, you cannot live for a single moment. You are alive. Your life is a proof that you are connected with the sound of God, with that silence, with that music melody. You are part of it, a note of that melody. What happens when you live with a master is that he is consciously connected and you are unconsciously connected. Not that you are not connected and he is connected. The difference is only of consciousness. He is consciously connected. He knows he is connected. And you don't know that you are connected. You are also connected. He simply helps you to become aware of the phenomena. He makes you aware of the fact. He does not connect you. These are the people who exploit. These are cunning people. Beware of them. Fourth, if you become his disciple, you may have to go through other incarnations, but never lower than you are now. Have you ever heard anybody going lower? There is no way to go lower. Nobody has ever gone lower. Because whatsoever you have learned, you have learned. And whatsoever you have known, you have known. You cannot fall back. There is no way of falling back. Everything moves ahead. That's why I say these are cunning people. They can make you afraid that if you don't become a disciple, you may become a dog. Or a crocodile. And then naturally fear arises, a crocodile, a dog. Then why not protect oneself, become a disciple of Charan Singh? At least you will not become a crocodile, you will not become a dog. Or there are worse things also, cockroaches and rats. And you can choose your own idea. Just think of becoming a cockroach. and great fear arises. And one would like not to become a cockroach. In the name of religion, people have been exploited down the ages, and these have been the trade secrets. If somebody is trying to create fear in you, or is trying to create greed in you, escape from that place. That place has nothing to do with religion. Because real religion has to free you from all greed and from all fear. These are the symptoms of a pathological situation. The man who is creating fear or greed, which are two aspects of the same coin. He will make you afraid of hell, hellfire, and he will make you greedy for heaven. But Charan Singh seems to be really clever and cunning. Because if you talk only of one heaven, then Jesus can lead you there, Buddha can lead you there, and Kabir can lead you there, and Nanak can lead you there. Anybody can do it. There are seven heavens. Now he has invented six more. And when people talk about such things, one of course starts feeling that others say only about one heaven and this man says about seven. He must be knowing more. Have you heard? You may not have heard a name. In Mahavira and Buddha's time, there was a man, may have been a past incarnation of Charan Singh. His name was Makhli Gosal. He talks about 700 hells and 700 heavens. Now he knows. And many people followed him. And the reason was there that Mahavir says only about one. And Makhli Gosal will say, look, he knows only about one. He has only entered the first. I know about 700. Now, if you want to go a little ahead, you cannot know 701. Nobody can prevent you. These are stories you can invent. These stories have prevailed in the name of religion. These are the stories that have destroyed the credibility of religion. These are the stories, and these cunning people are the root cause of irreligiousness in the world. Because of these people, suspicions have arisen. Remember, let me repeat it again. A real master never makes you afraid. In fact, he makes you fearless. He says there is no hell. He says there is no heaven. These are all psychological states. Hell is nothing but a projection of inner agony, and heaven also a projection of inner excess. The states are inner, and you can be free only when you are free of both. It happened, a mystic woman, Rabia, was seen in Baghdad one day. People used to think she is mad. She was a real master. Real masters have always been thought to be mad, because they speak a language that people don't understand. They speak the language of fearlessness, freedom, truth. They don't talk about fear and greed. And that's what is understood in the marketplace. People saw Rabia running, and they asked, where are you going? And she was creating almost a scene, a crowd gathered. Because in one hand she was having a burning torch. And another hand she was carrying an urban park full of water. And she was running so fast that people thought there must be some emergency. And they asked, "Where are you going, Rabia, and what is happening?" And she said, "Unless I drown hell with my water and burn heaven with my fire, this world is going to remain irreligious." When you come close to a real master, he gives you the taste of fearlessness. There is no way of falling back. Nobody has ever fallen back. Nobody can fall back. This is a stupid idea, but millions are there who become very much impressed by stupid ideas. In fact, they become impressed only by stupid ideas. And fifth, that there are at least seven heavens, each higher than the other, and only seven saints can take you up. Other saints can only take you up to the second heaven, where Jesus and Buddha live. So generous of charity. At least he allowed these poor fellows, Buddha and Jesus, to live in the second. He may not have allowed, it is his story. Generous, I am thankful. What about Nanak and Kabir? And what about the other saints and masters who are not so well known as Buddha and Jesus? He has allowed Buddha and Jesus just to attract Buddhists and Christians. But what about less known masters? Kabir and Nanak must be in the first. What about poor Muhammad? If Charan Singh can allot him some place in the first, that will be too much. And what about Yoka? Are sinners like me? If we can get place even in the seventh hell, that will be too great. This type of game is very old, it is not new. These people are mad egoists. Beware of such people. Avoid them. And you say, "I am not a disciple of Charan Singh and have no desire to become one, but the Radhaswami books did leave me very puzzled." There is danger. If you are puzzled, you have already become impressed. If you are puzzled, you have already taken one step towards disciplehood. Why you should be puzzled even? Can't you see that crap is crap? Why should you be puzzled? It is so simple. Please don't be puzzled, otherwise there is danger. Once you are puzzled, you have started thinking about it. And once you start thinking about it, you will need some explanation. And these people are very clever in explanation. Because their whole idea is fictitious, explanations are possible. Clever explanations are possible. Truth cannot be explained, but lies can be explained very beautifully. There are lies, man-made. You can adjust your lie to any explanation. Truth is uncompromising. So if you become puzzled, you will read more books, you will become more puzzled, and sooner or later, you will have to go to Bihar, to Punjab, to have such Sanghist currency. And there, more fear will arise, and more greed. And soon you will be trapped. So Mr. H. Khan Crosby, don't be puzzled. There is no need to be puzzled. One should be intelligent enough to see threat as threat. It is nothing more. The fourth question. You always say that you are not there. Everyone else says they look into your eyes and there is no one there. How is it that I always experience the opposite, that you are there and you are the only one who is really there? Savita, truth is always paradoxical. If it is not paradoxical, it is not truth. The only way to be is not to be. Only when one is absent, presence arises. So both are true. Those who look into my eyes and see nobody there are right, absolutely right. And Savita, you are also right. That when you look into my eyes, you see the only one who is really there. And these two experiences don't contradict each other. They complement. If somebody is looking for an ego into me, for a personality, he will not find. There is no personality there. The personality has disappeared. It was a dream, and I no more entertain any dream. It was a guest. Now the only one who lives inside me is the host. Those who are looking for the guest, they will not find the guest. They will not see any person there. Somebody who can say, I. They will go inside and they will look all around and they will not find any center who can say, I. That center is no more there. That complex has dissolved. So they are true, they come out and they say, we see inside and there is no one there. But if you are not looking for the person, if you are not looking for the center, if you are not looking for somebody, if you are not looking for the guest, then you will see some immense presence. Not a person, not a personality, but a presence. A person is grass, fictitious. It is a persona, a mask. A presence is just a radiance. I am empty as far as the person is concerned. I am full as far as the presence is concerned. Abundantly full. If you look directly into me, not looking for the guest, then you will find the host. It depends what you are looking for. You go in a room You are looking for somebody and he is not there, and you say the room is empty, he is not there. But there are 1,000 other things in the room. But you are not talking about them. The furniture is there, the clock is there, it's still ticking. The painting is on the wall. Everything is there. But the room is empty. Because you are looking for somebody who is not there. It depends for whom you are looking. It depends on you what you will find. And both outlooks are valid. Because both things have happened. I have disappeared and I have come. I am no more and only now I am. Truth functions as paradox. And to understand the paradox is to go beyond intellect. And the real understanding is always transcendental. And by transcendental, what is meant is paradoxical. The fifth question, did I hear you rightly? There is nothing that can be done to stop the misery. No decoration or pruning is going to do any good. Veda, you heard me absolutely right. Yes, there is nothing that can be done to stop the misery. If you go on doing something to stop the misery, you go on creating it. That's how it persists. That's how you nourish it. You feed it. If you are doing something to stop misery, you are creating it. Because the doing creates the doer. The doing brings the ego. And the ego is the pattern. And the doing keeps you tense. And the doing creates anxiety, whether you are going to make it or not. The doing keeps you anxious, always trembling, and that is misery. And the doing never allows you rest. How can you rest unless you have done that which you need to do? Unless you have arrived, you cannot relax. You can relax only in the tomorrow, but the tomorrow never comes. All that comes is today. And you have still to do something. You are sacrificing today for your tomorrow. And this is the only stupid thing that man has to be aware of. Don't sacrifice this moment for any other moment. Don't sacrifice this life for any heaven. First, second, fifth, seventh, don't sacrifice for anything. This moment has to be lived as this moment. Just this. Only this. Don't sacrifice it, because the next moment may never come. In fact, it never comes. You sacrifice this for the next, and then you will sacrifice the next, and so on and so forth. And one day you will die, and you will be just sacrificing and sacrificing. Sacrifice is misery. If you want to do something to stop misery, you will never be able to stop it. But if you have heard me, and not only intellectually, because I use simple words, there is nothing that can be done to stop the misery. If you have heard it, misery will stop immediately. That's what yoga calls cutting the root. Stop doing anything to stop the misery. And I'm not saying try to stop. Otherwise you move again. you start again on the same trip in a different name with a different flag. That's why yoga says the root can be cut directly, immediately, right now. This is the moment, now or never. One day it happens, Ramakrishna is sitting under the tree and the disciples are working. Somebody is cleaning the garden and somebody is cooking and somebody is doing something else. And he is sitting under the tree, praying, singing, chanting. And then suddenly he shouted, "This is it! Now or never!" It was so sudden that the man who was cleaning the garden path stopped. The man who was cooking stopped. The people who were sitting there with closed eyes opened their eyes and stopped whatever they were doing. For a moment, bliss descended. Benediction was there. Ramakrishna laughed. He said, "You see, and you go and searching for it, and it is here." And one man touched his feet and thanked him. But Ramakrishna said, "Don't thank me. I have not done anything. I simply found it. This is it, now or never. And you heard it. Thank yourself. Now keep reminding. Now don't start a journey towards the goal called bliss, God, paradise, truth. Be here." And misery has gone. Where is the misery? Look. Veda, look right now. Where is misery? If you have heard me rightly, if you have heard me at all, where is the misery? In this moment, is there any misery? Look inside. All has stopped. It is so silent. The benediction is upon you. And this can be your life forever and forever. This is my life. This is your birthright to claim it. If you stop doing anything to stop misery, misery stops. That's the miracle. You are just doing something like a dog. Have you seen a dog chasing its own tail? And the dog starts getting crazy. Because the more he tries to chase his tail, and it looks so close by, just lying there, and when he jumps, the tail jumps. And naturally the dog gets offended. A dog, after all, is a dog. He rushes more forcibly. Natural logic. All dogs are logicians. The natural logic is that he is not running enough after it. That's why he cannot catch it. That's the logic in the marketplace. That is the logic of the politician. That if you are not getting what you want, that so simply you are not running enough, that you are not going fast enough, go fast. Find more speedy means. That's the whole logic of this century, speed. If you are unhappy, then you must be going very slow, towards it. Go fast. Hire a jet plane and go fast. Faster you go, the better. Higher, greater the speed, the better. This is the logic. This has nothing very special about it. Dogs have the same logic. And then the dog jumps. And faster it goes, and round it goes. But it cannot catch the tail. And it is so close by, just by the corner. And he can look. It is there. Just think of a dog. Just become a dog for a moment and think. So close, and you cannot catch it. Are you important or something? It is such a challenge. Then the dog is exhausted, falls on the ground, panting, and it is there. He avoids to look at it, because it is so tempting. And it is his own tail. There is no need to catch it. There is the catch. There is no need to catch it. It is already yours. That's what is happening, Veda. If you are trying to become happy, trying to become not miserable, trying to stop misery and attain to blissfulness, you are chasing a tail that looks close by, but you will never be able to get at it because it is already yours. You already possess it. Stop chasing and see the root of the tail, and you will find it, it is joined with you. And you don't need any master to join your tail with you. No currency is needed to connect. You are connected. Did I hear you rightly? There is nothing that can be done to stop the misery. No decoration or pruning is going to do any good. You still want something to be occupied with. You are still hoping. I will say, no, Veda, there is something. I will give you a secret initiation, Veda, come to me. There is something, a sacred mantra that I give only to special people, chosen few. There is nothing sacred. And there is nothing special, because nothing has to be done. God has done it already. The world is as perfect as it ever can be. You are as perfect as you ever can be. In fact, you are more perfect than you can imagine yourself ever to be. Just relax. No need to stop anything. If misery is there, it is there. You don't do anything about it. Leave it there. Be respectful to it and leave it there. And you will be surprised that just leaving it there is cutting the root. You are no more feeding it. You are no more tense, no more anxious, no more in anguish. Misery is there and you are not miserable. How long the misery can remain? It is going to die. It will disappear soon. It was created by our running. It was the smoke created by our rush and speed. And if you cannot learn it here, where I had transformed the air into wine, where you will learn. Here it is happening. You have just to be open to it. It is already happening. All is perfect in this moment. So you are. Moment with no endeavor, with no effort, with nowhere to go, is God. in this moment, relaxed, you are that, Tattvamasi, thou art that. In this moment, nothing is missed, nothing is missing. This I call intoxication. Intoxication with the moment with existence. You have to learn to breathe this air. That is satsang. That is being with Master. The sixth question, how can anyone who has not realized his true Buddha nature help feeling inferior in your presence every morning? Krishna Prabhu, then there must be something wrong in your mind. To feel inferior in my presence, and I go on provoking again and again that you are Buddha. Can you find anybody anywhere who will respect you more than I respect you? My whole work consists in one thing, of reminding you that you are Buddha, that you are gods and goddesses, that you have fallen in a dream and you think yourself like a beggar or a tramp, but you are not. Why you should feel inferior in my presence? In my presence you should feel at the very top of the world. Because I am not separate from you. I am that which you can become any moment, this moment. I am simply a representation of all that you can be. How can you feel inferior in my presence? There must be something else. It is not my presence that makes you feel inferior. It must be somewhere deep down a very subtle ego. You want to feel superior in my presence. That is creating the trouble. If you want to feel superior in my presence, then you will feel inferior. You are the cause of it, not my presence. If you want to feel superior, it will be difficult. You will not be able to manage it. You will fall short. You will again and again slip. And then you will feel inferior. Inferiority is created when you want to feel superior. Inferiority is the shadow. If you love me, who is inferior and who is superior? In love, all superiority, all inferiority disappears. The master is not superior than the disciple. The disciple is not inferior than the master. The master knows, is aware of the disciple's perfection. The disciple is not aware. But nobody is inferior and nobody is superior. And when a disciple bows down to the master, it is not because of inferiority, but because it is only in the presence of the master that for the first time all inferiority disappears. That's why he bows down. It is out of gratitude that it is only your presence where I don't feel rotten, where I don't feel rubbish, where I don't feel like warm, where suddenly my reality blooms. It is only in your presence that I remember my own innermost core, that it is in your presence that my flame burns bright, that I am aflame with love, with presence, with awareness. Hence I bow down, not because of any inferiority. It is because all inferiority disappears. And I am not saying when inferiority disappears, you start feeling superior. When inferiority disappears, all feeling of superiority also disappears. They live together, they are together. They cannot be separated. The man who feels superior is still feeling inferior somewhere. The man who feels inferior wants to feel superior somewhere. They come in pairs. They cannot be separated. They are always there. The man who says, I am humble, is simply trying to prove himself superior, wants to be superior. That's what happens to your so-called saints. They become humble, but they don't become simple. Simple means no inferiority, no superiority. Can't you visualize what I mean? One simply is no comparison. Superiority, inferiority arise out of comparison. You start comparing. It happens. A Zen master is sitting in satsang. His disciples are there. A very proud man, a warrior, a samurai came to see him. The samurai is a very famous one, well known all over the country. But looking at the master, looking at the beauty of the master and the grace of the moment, he suddenly felt inferior. He had come, maybe with an unconscious desire, to prove his superiority. He said to the master, why I am feeling inferior? Just a moment before, everything was okay. As I entered into your court, I am suddenly feeling inferior. I have never felt like this. My hands are shaking. I am a warrior. I have faced death many times. And I have never felt any fear. Why I am feeling frightened? The master said, you wait. When everybody is gone, I will answer. People continued coming. And the man was getting tired and tired. And by the evening, the room was empty, there was nobody. And the samurai said, now, can you answer it? And the master said, now, come out. A full moon night. The moon was just rising on the horizon. And he said, look at this tree, high in the sky, and this tree is small. They both have existed by the side of my window for years. And there has never been a problem. The smaller tree has not ever said, why I feel inferior before you, to the big tree. How is it possible? This tree is small and that tree is big. And I have never heard any whisper. The samurai said, because they can't compare. The master said, then you need not ask me. You know the answer. Comparison brings inferiority, superiority. When you don't compare, all inferiority, all superiority disappears. Then you are. You are simply there. A small bush or a high, big tree, it doesn't matter. You are yourself. You are needed. A grass leaf is needed as much as the biggest star. Without the grass leaf, God will be less than he is. This sound of the cuckoo is needed as much as any Buddha. The world will be less rich if this cuckoo disappears. Just look around. all is needed and everything fits together. It is an organic unit. Nobody is higher, nobody is lower. Nobody superior, nobody inferior. Everybody is incomparably unique. If you cannot feel this in my presence, where you are going to feel it? Every day, morning, evening, I bow down to you, just to remind you that you are perfect, that nothing is lacking, that you are already there. Not even a single step has to be taken. That from the very beginning, everything is as it should be. This is religious consciousness.
The seventh question. Beloved Bhagwan, yes, 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 Bhagwan, yes. Mukta, that's what prayer is. Prayer consists only of one single word, yes. That is the meaning of Amen. It means yes. If you can say yes with your total heart, you have said all that can be said, that need be said. If you can say yes with your total heart, you are in celebration. If you can say yes to existence, you have arrived. Get deeper and deeper into yes. Say yes to each and everything. Say yes to good and bad, to day and night, to summer and winter. Say yes to success and to failure. Say yes to life and to death. Forget everything else. Just remember one word, yes. And it can transform your whole being. It can become a radical change, a revolution. Yes is all that is meant by prayer. People say so many words, meaningless. Just one word is enough. And the last question. Why should the poor sun rise in the evening? Is the morning not enough? But the morning is perfectly beautiful, but not enough. It is only the half. It is only the part. The sun has to rise in the evening too. Then life is total. One has to rejoice not only in life but in death too, then life is total. One has to rejoice not only in love but in aloneness too, then the dance is complete. That's why I say I have seen the sun rising in the evening. The circle is complete. The evening is the other side of the morning. If the sun only rises in the morning, then you will become attached to the morning. And when the evening comes, you will not be able to say yes to it. And the evening is coming. If the morning has come, the evening is coming. If you are born, you will be dying. The sun has to rise in your death too. You have to die like a Buddha, with a song in the heart. which he is saying. You have to die like Krishna. He's still playing on his flute. What is the meaning of the sun rising in the evening? It has an immense significance. It has a great message for you. I am saying that life in all its colors is beautiful. That nothing has to be denied, rejected. That nothing has to be desired. That nothing has to be renounced. That all has to be accepted in great joy, in great gratitude. And then the sun rises in the evening too. And the beauty of it is immense. Because everybody knows the sun that rises in the morning. And very few know the sun that rises in the evening. The moment you can see the sun rising in the evening, you have become a Buddha. Then all is good. When all is good, then all is God. Enough for today.